Coming up on today's program, food production and the high cost of farming. That's just some of what we've got for you. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekends with WISO. Coming up later in the program, we'll meet the new president and CEO of YWCA Dayton, Barbara Ward. And our very own Dan Patterson is back with Blue Skies and Tailwinds. First, we've got a roundup of some of the news stories our reporters covered last week. We'll start with Catherine Mobley's report on the ending of temporary protected status for Haiti and Syria, which officially ended, making all connected work permits and driver's licenses invalid. In Springfield, the religious and nonprofit communities continued to rally around their Haitian neighbors, supporting families who can no longer legally work.
The summons to Haitians who have just lost their TPS status is in the form of a letter from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. Vilas Dorsonville is executive director of the Springfield Haitian Support Center. He says since July 27th, he's driven more than a dozen former TPS-holding immigrants to Blue Ash, each armed with all of their immigration papers.
When they get there, they interview them, and eventually they put an in-call monitor on them.
They also receive a court date 30 days out from this check-in meeting. Dorsonville says if people cannot make the appointment, they must write a reason on the form, scan it, and email it back within 24 hours.
There is one mother who went to that appointment, and when she came back home, she did not even want her kids to notice that she has that ankle monitor. And I am grieving with this family for that, because most of the time I think that they put ankle monitor on criminals. They're not criminals. It's really humiliating to see that happening to my people.
According to Columbus immigration attorney Ina Simakoski, if people don't appear for the check-in appointment or if they refuse to wear the ankle monitor, they will be arrested and deported. Dorsonville and his team are busy helping their countrymen navigate the ever-growing uncertainty for some Haitian immigrants in the wake of losing TPS.
I know I have faith in the Lord, but I don't know what the Lord is about to do. If only he can reveal something to me.
Reporting for WYSO News, I'm Catherine Mobley.
And you can contact the Ohio Immigrant Hotline at 419-777-4357 or reach them through the website at ohioimmigrant.org. Up next, WYSO's Adriana Martinez-Smiley reports that a federal agency wants sweeping changes. The regulations could prevent historic Ohio tribes from saving their sacred sites.
The regulations can be found in Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. It requires federally funded or permitted projects to seek ways to avoid, minimize, or mitigate damaging impacts on recognized historic properties. It also requires notification and consultation with local governments, state historic preservation offices, and tribal historic preservation offices or governments. Late last month, the Federal Agency Advisory Council on Historic Preservation voted by email to loosen these regulations. The revisions make consultation optional and narrows what's considered damaging. NPR reports a memo from the council that justifies the decision, saying the current rules create confusion and delays for the public and agencies. The changes have drawn criticism from tribal representatives, archaeologists, historic preservation officers, and some politicians. Greg Werkheiser, co-founder of the law firm Cultural Heritage Partners, says these changes would reduce tribes' abilities to consult on historic sites in their homelands.
So it is very possible that tribes show up one day and see bulldozers going through a sacred site and have had no notice, let alone an opportunity to participate.
Many federally recognized tribes no longer live in their homelands due to colonization and forced removal. That includes Ohio. The changes aren't official. The agency has to allow public comments. The public comment period hasn't been announced. Werkheiser says the revised regulations will likely lead to lawsuits. For WYSO News, I'm Adriana Martinez-Smiley.
And WISO reached out to Ohio History Connection, which oversees the state's Historic Preservation Office, for comment. In an email, Preservation Officer Diana Welling says she's closely monitoring the process and, quote, working to ensure that preservation partners, local governments, consulting parties, applicants, property owners, and interested members of the public have access to accurate information about the proposed changes and the federal comment process, end quote. Welling says the goal is to keep Ohio's preservation community up to date on the proposal, and she says the office will share information and resources in the coming weeks. And finally, let's take a look at the Ohio State Fair's new Ohio Agriculture Center. The center opened its doors for the first time this year at the Ohio State Fair, boasting local food purveyors, Ohio-made products, and an educational wing for visitors of all ages. Shay Frank has more.
As I walk into the Ohio State Fair's all-new Ohio Agriculture Center, I am met with a massive dining hall, lined with restaurants selling locally sourced lamb, chicken, beef, and more. But it's not your typical food hall. There's also an education and shopping area. Local products like honey, wine, tortilla chips, and more are for sale, alongside Made in Ohio swag in the Ohio Proud Store. Brian Baldridge is director of the Ohio Department of Agriculture. He says this new air-conditioned center is part of a collaborative effort.
Our state legislature has put in, with the leadership of the governor, put in about $460 million to this campus. This is the investment is generational, without a doubt. The state fair was founded on agriculture.
And after shopping, visitors can tour an interactive exhibit organized by the Ohio Farm Bureau.
Hey there, fairgoers. Let's take a stroll through a year in Ohio agriculture.
The showcase was created with help from the Ohio Veterinary Medicine Association and experts in horticulture, floriculture, and more. That's according to Ryan Matthews. He works for the Ohio Farm Bureau.
I think it goes into one showcasing Ohio's most important industry, right? And people understanding just how important agriculture is to their lives every single day, going back to that food, fiber, and fuel we all rely on. And having it all in one space also showcases how much unity there is in agriculture.
Visitors can tour the new facility through August 9th. Baldridge says the center will be open during other events at the fairgrounds, including the largest single-breed horse show in the world in October.
Also at the Ohio State Fair, they're teaching those with diverse abilities how to make safe sensory snacks. The center invited a number of people with disabilities to attend a cooking demonstration in July, showing them how to make nutritious and easy snacks with those Ohio-made products.
Only standing room was left in the Ohio-made store at the State Fair during this demonstration. Audience members cheered and interacted with the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities Medical Director Laura Sorg as she demonstrated how to make a lemon hummus.
Who likes fruit? Who are my fruit people? I love fruit too. Yeah. Who are my veggie people? Oh, come on. Anybody? A couple. Okay.
Sorg walked the packed room through tools and techniques that make eating local fruits, veggies, and cheeses easier and safer for all ability types. She says making things like a dip from Ohio soybeans is a great way to stay healthy, get necessary protein, and support local growers.
So we want to know people, you know, make sure that people know that they can eat a variety of fruits and vegetables raised here in Ohio that also can still be safe when they're eating those.
Sorg says the State Department hosts seasonal cooking classes like these often. For WYSO News, I'm Shay Frank.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Well, we've heard a bit about food production and preparation. Up next, we'll hear about the cost of getting that food to the table in Today from the Ohio Newsroom.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, the climbing costs of running a farm.
Support comes from the James at Ohio State. Cancer. For some, it's one of life's fiercest foes, but not at the James, where a team of nearly 300 specialists and over 1,500 researchers are working together to create a cancer-free world.
I'm Erin Gottsacker. A bipartisan group of agricultural leaders are warning Congress of a deepening crisis on America's farms. The cost of fertilizer has more than doubled since 2020. Fuel costs surged following the war in Iran, and U.S. agricultural exports are at their lowest levels in years. Farmers across the country are reaching a breaking point. Last year, farm bankruptcies rose by 46%, a trend that's carried into this year, too. I spoke with five farmers across Ohio about their experiences this growing season and how the increased costs are weighing on them.
So I'm Bennett Musselman. I farm in Pickaway, Madison in Franklin County. It's kind of been a gut punch, I guess, a little bit with the prices. Every time you go to purchase something, it was more expensive this year than it was last year, all the way down to parts and oil and you know, general maintenance things. It's just, it stacks up quite a bit. This year, we had an opportunity to pick up a farm. Two guys were retiring, so we had to buy some fertilizer late in the game, and that was it's these new farms, that profitability is going to be very, very tough. But if you don't take advantage of the opportunity, you may not ever get that opportunity again.
My name's Carrie Starr. I'm the co-owner of Cherokee Valley Bison Ranch. My husband and I have been raising bison here in Thornville for a little over 18 years now. Big surprise, not everybody in Ohio wants to process bison, so we have to drive 2 hours one way to get to our butcher. Instead of it costing me $60 to $80 to fill up my truck, it's going to be $80 to $120 to fill up my truck. So I've been trying to batch trips, so taking a couple of animals at a time to help stretch that fuel dollar.
I'm Cy Prettyman. I farm here in North Central Ohio with my family. We raise corn, soybeans, and we do some beef cattle that we do direct to consumer. We were paying over $4, maybe over $4.50 or so for off-road diesel in the spring. And when you fill up tractors that have 300 or 400 gallon tanks on them, just do the math real quick on that. That's a very big expense. So we definitely kind of went hand to mouth, just as small amount as we needed to try to get through the spring.
I'm Annie Wormke, and I'm the owner and farmer of Wormke Farm Food Forest Garden. I have a different situation, but it's still impacting me. I have to drive 25 miles to the produce auction. And when I start to add all that up, I don't make money. I don't make any money. It costs me to take my produce to the auction.
Chris Gibbs from Shelby County, Ohio. I'm a farmer, raise corn, soybeans, alfalfa hay, and we've got 90 beef cows. We're in the middle of our third year of cash flow losses. Agriculture right now is in a cash flow and working capital crisis. If I was totally in the grain business and that's all the income I had, we'd be in real trouble. We'd have to go to reserves. We'd have to go to savings. We'd have to go to additional borrowing. We would have to do refinancing. There's a time when your banker is going to say, hey, no, we just can't go on anymore because you don't have the capacity to repay in the future. Worst case scenario, we may have to quit and let somebody else farm.
You just heard from Ohio farmers Chris Gibbs, Annie Wormke, Cy Prettyman, Carrie Starr, and Bennett Musselman talking about the rising costs of farming this year. That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
Up next on Why So Weekend, YWCA Dayton has a new president and CEO. Barbara Ward just started that job last week, but she's no stranger to the organization and its mission. She spoke with us about her history there and that mission going forward.
It is truly an honor, really, to now lead a mission that has been changing lives in our community for more than 150 years. Because of my past tenure with the organization, first starting as part of the inaugural class of Sojourn, post-COVID, and then matriculating as a volunteer to come on staff as an advocacy manager back in the day. I know our staff, our partners, and our mission, and I'm really excited to build on that strong foundation while preparing YWCA Dayton for the future.
It's nice that you can move forward with an organization that you are so familiar with.
Yes. I mean, and my goal is very simple. I mean,
to really build upon the strength of what we do and ensure that every woman in her family and their family who needs us knows that we're here and has access to the support they deserve. So.
And you've got to be offering that support with other organizations that you're collaborating with, correct?
Oh, for sure. Because last year alone, we provided 13,330 safe bed nights, served 186 survivors through our emergency shelter, supported 73 individuals through 65 apartments through our permanent supportive housing apartments, and helped 97 people move towards safe, stable housing through our rapid rehousing services. And so that all of those programs and all of those services provided could not be possible without partnerships within our community. And so we're grateful for those.
YWCA Dayton took a big step forward several years ago with the onboarding of residential housing. And so that downtown Dayton campus has expanded quite a bit. How are you folks getting organized down there?
So right now we are centralizing all of our operations and our programming right here in Dayton, in the city of Dayton, but serve, of course, all families, women within the Miami Valley region and beyond. And so we have centralized our programming right here on West 3rd.
You mentioned building on what YWCA Dayton has already accomplished, but what are some personal ideas or goals that you want to work into the mission going forward?
Yeah, sure. First of all, community has always been at the heart of YWCA Dayton's success, and we have always been in pursuit of the mission. And as we lean into this next chapter, we want to be excellent at the programming and the services that we do. We want to do what we do and do it well. YWCA Dayton provides very unique services. As I mentioned, we are the only domestic violent shelter, imminent danger shelter in Montgomery County. And we do provide safe housing for women who are experiencing chronic homelessness due to their mental health. And so through our programs, we want to do what we do and do it well, as there are several other great organizations in community that do what they do. And so that's why partnerships are great. And so my goal, especially in this next chapter, is to continue to strengthen those programs so that we could be trusted and continue to be trusted by community, be that space of hope for women and their families here. And of course, continue to build upon the partnerships and this collective effort to really address the needs of those fleeing domestic violence and seeking safe and safety. I definitely continue to stress that we are here for those who need us. And you can always visit ywcadayton.org to learn more about the programs and services that we have. You can make a gift, volunteer your time, attend either of our fundraising events, Women of Influence, which will be on March 4th, and Voices Against Violence, which will be in October, Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so continue to just learn opportunities about what we do and how we can connect with community. And one of the most important things you can do, of course, is spread the word. I think too many people don't realize help is available. And by sharing our mission, supporting our work, and making a donation, you're helping ensure that when someone needs us as a safe place to turn, YWCA Dayton is ready to open the door.
Barbara Ward is the new president and CEO of YWCA Dayton. Barbara, thanks so much for your time and good luck to you and the organization.
Well, thanks for the conversation, Jerry. It truly is an honor, and I'm excited about the work we will all continue to do together.
Coming up, we've got Bird Note to wrap up the program, but first, a new report from site selection consulting firm Global Location Strategies puts the Dayton region third in the nation for aerospace and defense manufacturing. The report highlights the area's long-standing ties to military innovation. Dan Patterson explains what's behind the ranking.
Well, finally the nation's business realms are realizing and talking about what we who have lived here have known for a long time. The genesis and genius of the Wrights is well known, and then there was a great vacuum of notice. The aviation world certainly knew this all along. Once the USA entered World War I and the fact that Deeds Kettering and the visionary city manager of Dayton, Fred Eichelberger, put this region on the global aviation map. That bet on the future paid off, as seen in the local economy over a century later. They opened McCook Field in 1917 with the Army Aviation Engineering Headquarters and swiftly began solving issues which would have long-term effects on flying that still resonate today. The development of the turbo supercharger in concert with General Electric led to sustained high-altitude flights. To do that, the engineering headquarters developed the systems and the flight clothing that made high-altitude flights survivable and sustainable for thousands of aircrew again to this day. The Dayton Engineers Club supported the efforts by having the finest aeronautical library east of the Mississippi River. The world's aviation communities came to Dayton to work with the engineers and to pay their respects to Orville Wright. As the rapid advances in aviation created larger and faster airplanes, it became obvious that McCook Field had been outgrown. And in the light of the rumors of the Army looking to relocate the headquarters to Langley Field in Virginia, the same visionaries assembled local business leaders and the local population to raise $400,000 over a weekend to purchase 5,000 acres and gifted that to the United States government to create Wright Field, which opened in 1927. The bet from 10 years prior had been remade and proved once again to be correct. What we now take for granted was created and nurtured and supported not only by the government, but the local communities. The air crews and the vast support systems, essential, both military and civilian, were welcomed with open arms. Communities such as Fairborn, Beaver Creek, and Riverside, as well as Dayton, flourished with the expansion and the need for satellite industries which need room to grow. The communities welcomed the air crews, ground support, and their families, and they all became neighbors, having kids in the local schools and shopping in the local stores. As the airbase continued to grow, the engineering organizations were created. For example, the Air Force Institute of Technology, Air Force Research Lab, and the now called Aerospace Medicine were founded in 1918 at McCook Field. Propulsion, founded in 1926, Foreign Technologies in 1942. Many other research programs were coalesced into the Wright Laboratories in 1990. The National Museum of the United States Air Force, founded in 1923, began as a strictly engineering archive and expanded into the world's largest military aviation museum, which draws visitors to this region from across the globe. So let's continue to quietly celebrate with revelations of the world outside our hometown and region what we have known all along: thriving communities with ample opportunities for jobs and growth. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
Blue Skies and Tailwinds is sponsored by Sinclair Community College and produced at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO.
This is Bird Note. Do you like to guess the bird before we identify it? Then here's a short quiz for you. Bird 1. Yes, that's the song of the American robin. Bird 2. The olive-sided flycatcher. In a few weeks, these flycatchers will leave for their wintering grounds in South and Central America. All right, here comes bird 3. Yup, that's the cry of a red-tailed hawk soaring overhead. How about this one? Did you answer blue jay? Nope. This is the Steller's jay. If you're west of the Rocky Mountains, you're most likely to hear the Steller's jay. East of the Rockies, you'll hear the blue jay. So, how'd you do? Let's run through them again. American robin. Olive-sided flycatcher. Red-tailed hawk. Steller's jay and blue jay. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Teton Science Schools, specializing in outdoor learning experiences and education in Grand Teton National Park. More at TetonScience.org.
Bird Note, putting a wrap on this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling. I'm Jerry Kenny. Join us again next weekend. We'll have more conversations and highlights for you then. Our theme music is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise, provided by Magnolia Bolthead. Let's spend some more time together next weekend.